Hey everybody, it's Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message Podcast. A really rotten week. A really rotten week for the world, for Brussels, for our Politico Europe brothers and sisters who were 500 feet away from one of the suicide bombers that killed so many people this week. It really underscores the seriousness of the consequences of this fall's presidential election and the emerging issue of terrorism and how we respond to those threats in the election. I can tell you, first of all, I want to give a huge shout out to the Politico Europe team who did just an incredible job. You know, a bunch of folks literally ran towards the sound of the explosions and into the smoke, into the subways. I mean, that's real reporting. You know, we talk a lot about punditry and talking heads and really the worst elements of our profession, but I think the Politico Europe folks really showed their mettle and really came back with some amazing first-person accounts. Go online and take a look at some of the stuff that they did. I'm really, as somebody who covered 9/11 and the aftermath, it's really very hard on folks, and I just couldn't be more proud to be associated with them. That said, a lot of the issues that Europe is dealing with, the Syrian civil war, and it has metastasized, and a lot of these fighters, veterans, have leached back over the border back into Europe. That's not an issue we as a country will face simply because of we're not as proximal to the conflict. But these are the core issues that are animating the foreign policy debate, particularly on the Republican side in 2016, and it's just going to continue to get more intense. The conventional wisdom on this is that Donald Trump benefits most from sort of the tough talk on terror, but this is a guy who at the moment hasn't, I guess he let leak a couple of potential names of advisors, but he does not have a serious platform on anti-terror stuff, just as he doesn't really have a serious platform on anything. On the Democratic side, I think there is a sense that Hillary Clinton, even though she can't really express this publicly at the moment because she's hugging Barack Obama, she needs to do that in the primaries, a sense among the Clinton people that they will take a tougher role than the Obama administration. And there was some criticism, some fair, some not, I'll just lay it out there, of Obama for remaining on his Cuba trip and going on to Argentina after the Belgium attacks, particularly considering the potential knock-on effects here and the fact that some Americans were victims of this attack in Europe. Perfect time. Into this maelstrom steps Michael Hayden, the former director of the CIA under George W. Bush and for 3 weeks under Barack Obama. He's out with a new book called Playing to the Edge. Really fascinating read. Talks about all these wars that he's had with Congress and reporters. You know, Hayden is a very interesting figure. He's kind of in the middle. On one hand, he continued the Bush administration's enhanced interrogation program or recommended its continuation, cut it down, pared it down, emptied out the dark sites in Europe, but kept them open. On the other hand, he has called for a greater sense of transparency, and part of his rationale in writing this book, and we talk about this at great length, is to give the public a greater understanding of these surveillance techniques and interrogation techniques, and we are going to be using them, folks. This attack in Brussels, unfortunately, won't be the last. The attack in San Bernardino won't be the last. These are likely issues that are going to get more and more pressing, even though they've kind of been dormant for a while. Another really interesting part about my conversation with Hayden, who was briefly an advisor to Jeb Bush's unsuccessful presidential campaign, I asked him a question I had heard first posed on Fox and Friends from the great national security expert Brian Kilmeade, who asked him who his first choice of the remaining candidates would be on national security, and he said John Kasich. I decided to ask him who his number two would be next to Kasich, and his answer was, a drum roll please, Hillary Rodham Clinton. Before we get to the general, we'll do a little bit of our usual business here. Love the letters, love the emails, a lot of good suggestions, gthrush@politico.com. Go on iTunes, register, for us to automatically appear in your inbox every week. You know, I haven't done it. I'm going to do it in like 10 minutes. And rate us. I've also not done that. I'm frankly not pleased with it. I may only give me 2 stars just to give myself some incentive. So without any further ado, General Michael Hayden. So, General, you grew up in Pittsburgh.
I did.
And it is my understanding that you had an up-close and personal view of the very worst Pittsburgh Steelers teams.
Throughout my youth, in the 50s and 60s, yeah, a long time without a title, I left, went on active duty in the Air Force. They hired Chuck Knoll, began to draft well. And I listened with near tears in my eyes to their first Super Bowl win on Armed Forces Radio on Guam.
You were on Guam. What were you doing there?
I was an intelligence officer for what was then 8th Air Force, B-52 Air Force. We were conducting regular bombardment Southeast Asia.
Was that Curtis LeMay's outfit, the 8th?
It is. Strategic Air Command, right, which owned the bombers, yes, was Curtis LeMay's command.
Did you ever meet Curtis LeMay?
I never met Curtis LeMay.
That's a shame, because that would have been a pretty good story.
Yeah.
Did you ever see Dr. Strangelove?
No, not personally.
You have never seen Dr. Strangelove?
The movie, yes.
Not actually, Dr. Strangelove. What did you think of the movie?
I love the movie. Sure. It was a movie of its time, bringing up some important issues. Yeah.
Very diplomatic answer.
Thank you.
So one of the things that you did, if I'm not mistaken, is you did... What was the first intelligence posting that you had in the Air Force? What did it entail?
The first thing I did after getting a master's degree, and the Air Force was very kind, they let me stay on at school to get a master's. I went to Denver for the Armed Forces Air Intelligence School. 6 months. Fundamentally, we had a major effort on in Southeast Asia, and this was training folks to support that effort.
This was the Rolling Thunder days?
Well, the Rolling Thunder was one of the operations, right, that was supported. I, however, after graduating, I graduated in the middle of winter. Rotations to Southeast Asia were in the summer, and so I was sent to Strategic Air Command headquarters in Omaha at Offutt Air Force Base, and my first job there was reading out drone imagery,
really,
of North Vietnam. They're called Buffalo Hunter drones, not nearly the sophistication, no live streaming video. It flew a pre-programmed path, we hope, took pictures along that path, and we developed the wet film,
wow,
and rolled it out on a light table and did our analysis.
So this was the kind of stuff that you'd see in movies about World War II?
It wasn't that much beyond what we were doing in World War II.
What was your first posting in an actual war zone?
Well, actually, I've been blessed. My time in war zones have been fleeting and infrequent. I've been to Iraq. I've been to Afghanistan. I've been to other places where I've collected hazardous duty pay. But I fought the war in Southeast Asia from Guam, supporting B-52 operations from there.
Was there a feeling, and you know, I have a lot of in-laws who are in the military, some of whom served in active duty. My father did. But was there a moment where what you were doing connected with real casualties? I mean, did you have a sense, obviously what you were doing were protecting American lives.
Right.
But did you ever have a moment of realization? Was there ever?
Sure.
How did that, do you remember the first time that really dawned on you?
I mean, the B-52, for example, at that time was a big, powerful weapon, but we weren't using precision-guided munitions. These were gravity bombs, and we actually bombed boxes. You could get a 3-ship B-52 over a box about 1 mile by 3 miles, and it walked 3 strings of bombs, 500-pound bombs, through those boxes. And so, you know, you wanted to target very well. I mean, obviously wouldn't use that in downtown Da Nang or anything. Right. It was out in the jungle. But, you know, that's an awful lot of firepower.
If you made a mistake, would you know it?
It would be hard, and that's a great question. You know, the demands for precision increase as your capacity for precision increase.
Right.
And so as we move forward, coming out of Vietnam, actually, at the very tail end of Vietnam was the first use of a laser-guided weapon, of a precision weapon. At that point, we began the what's the right word, the transformation of certainly America's Air Force. And what we did was we began to trade in mass, which is one of the principles of war that you need to win. We began to trade in mass for precision, or put in a more accurate way. We began to create with precision the effects that we formerly could create only with mass. And so we went from a world in which you laid out strings of Mark 82 bombs in a 1x3 mile box,
right,
to a world in which you could achieve some of the same effects with one weapon, with absolute precision, going after one specific target. Right? Now, what that meant for me as a professional is that my information had to be at least as precise as our weapons.
Right.
And so we also saw not just a transformation going from mass to precision, but we also saw a transformation in which our demand for absolutely exquisite intelligence
and they increased. Became a more and with that also became a public a lack of a public acceptance of the larger larger casualties, right?
You know, I don't know, I can't prove cause and effect.
Yep.
But in parallel, as we got more precise weapons, as we had a higher demand for exquisite intelligence, the American tolerance overall for collateral damage went down as well.
What made you? Now you were a. I'm trying to remember. You were a humanity. You were a history.
History major.
You were a history major, right? What attributes? When did you sort of realize that this was your line of work?
Oh well, first of all, I went into intelligence because I was a history major.
Right.
I felt there was good transference of the skills of that discipline to the skills required of the intelligence discipline.
I'm curious about
sure.
that.
Sure, it's about research. It's about understanding. It's about presentation. You know, it's gathering evidence. It's testing hypotheses, and then
so you must have
trying
some,
to tell truth.
So you must have written some pretty good papers.
Well, in
you were
in
good
school,
at writing papers, right?
I enjoyed writing in school. I don't know that I was all that good at it in school. I worked at it later. I feel comfortable writing now. I enjoy writing now. I suspect, like most college students, I viewed writing then to be more tedious.
But it's a synthesis you enjoyed.
I did.
So that's the thing.
Now, that's a great word.
Yeah.
All right. I don't think I'm bad as an analyst. I don't think I'm bad as a researcher, but I actually think I'm better at synthesizing. So one of the techniques I had at CIA and at NSA, and I talk about this in the book, Playing to the Edge, is I would sit there in a room with really smart people. And my technique was simply to ask them questions. And not pushing back and, you know, challenging so much as to, why do you think that? Well, what about that? Well, is that consistent with what you've said, told me, at other times? And I would draw out, I think, the best of my analysts. And then very often, I would say, thank you very much. They gave me a stack of papers. I may have looked at them, may have highlighted them a little bit, back to college days with the yellow highlighter. And then I would turn around and I would face the screen of my own computer and I would write notes for the President of the United States the next morning.
To some extent, that sounds repertorial.
It's very repertorial. We had Bob Woodward come out to NSA once for one of our law days, actually, to talk to a large luncheon gathering. And Bob went right through the drill saying that, you know, what I, Bob Woodward, do is an awful lot like what you do.
You pull the information. You
challenge
it,
you compare it,
and then
hypothesize, test the hypothesis.
And then you ultimately make a judgment on which you will be judged as being...
Right.
But let me just one
more line on that.
Of course.
You're a storyteller. I mean, you can't throw data through the transom and expect a policymaker to digest it and make a decision on it. You actually have to tell the story. And that's what an intelligence officer does.
Therein also lies the danger sometimes, right?
Well, okay, so now you're really getting into the science. And again, this is I treat this a bit in some of the chapters. There are a lot of things that are true. Let's take the really ugly, hideous, complex situation in Syria.
Right.
What's the major plot line? What's the major plot? What's the subplot?
Right.
By the way, all the plot lines are true. This could be viewed as autocrat versus Democrat.
Right.
The plot is humanitarian. This could be viewed as Sunni versus Alawite. That plot is sectarian.
Right.
All right. This could be viewed as a contest between Shiism and Sunnism.
Right.
All right. That's a completely different plot that began in 632. This could be viewed as, you know, if you don't do something here, big guy, we're going to end up with a terrorist state the size of Indiana
right.
in the middle of the Middle East. That's another equally true plot line. And a last plot line is, in a very strange way, this is back to East-West again. Where do the Russians come from? Right. How did that happen? Every one of those plots is correct. And now you've got to decide, how are you going to organize your data that morning
right.
for the President of the United States? Because if you look at each of those plot lines carefully,
right.
each of them suggests a different course of action.
And, well, we'll get into some specifics in a bit, but making those judgments, how confident at the end of your tenure were you that you were choosing the right plot line? And when you look back... Can you give me an example? I hate to do this, but the negatives were always more interesting than the positives. Can you think of a moment where you chose the wrong plot line?
Sure. The Iraq Weapons of Mass Destruction National Intelligence Estimate, where we chose the plot line that he's got a program right. and that he's doing this, and rejected alternative views. And there are reasons for that, but let me just develop
sure.
that a bit, because I talk about this a great deal. We lowballed Iraq's nuclear program after Gulf War I. And like most bureaucracies, you know, if you're throwing the ball in the dirt, we're never going to throw the ball in the dirt again. We're going to get that pitch up.
Right.
And so there was a natural bureaucratic tendency. We're not going to lowball this guy. Secondly, you had Saddam, for his own reasons, acting like he had a program, not to impress us, but to scare the Iranians.
Of course.
All right. We weren't sensitive enough to those other
You weren't reading the body language.
Those
right.
other influences.
Right.
And then I go on to say that it wasn't just that we were wrong, which we were. We did not portray to our clients how sure, or in some cases, how unsure we were in our conclusions. We believed our conclusions to be correct. And by the way,
yeah.
one of the plot lines is not that some vice president drove up the GW Parkway and held a gun to our head and say
right.
and said, You're very clear
yeah. in you're right. very clear in your book. You don't go for the Dick Cheney, Dr. Evil storyline.
But right. when we finally wrote our expository prose, when I read it now, it is far more confident than we were even then. That was the biggest sin.
Did you have a feeling on the back of your neck as you were finalizing those documents? And I'm sure you've played this over
sure.
and over in your head. Was there a soupçon of doubt? Was there a feeling in the back of your neck that you now validate?
No, I was pretty comfortable. And I'll tell you why,
yeah.
all right? And this just is not meant to dodge the bullet.
Sure.
You just shot out here. I was the director of the National Security Agency. I was not the head of an all-source intelligence agency. My role in this was, what does my signals intelligence tell me about those proposed key
right.
judgments?
Right.
And all of my SIGINT ranged somewhere between ambiguous and confirmatory. And so it was a pretty easy matter for me to raise my right hand and
right.
say, yeah, I'm with you, George.
Because you were not the ultimate synthesizer.
I was not in that case.
In terms of, let's talk, okay, since you brought up the issue of certainty, I'm going to veer way off the George Washington Park. We're going on to the Chain Bridge here. We have a presidential candidate right now who speaks with the utmost certainty about absolutely everything.
Yes, yes. Clear, crisp, precise, and wrong.
Right. So let me use a term that perhaps you're familiar with, the term bullshit.
it's a technical term in our discipline, yes.
To what extent do you think, when you hear someone out there using these terms, and you said recently that you think Kasich of the remaining
right.
is the, and I presume that you thought Jeb also had a...
Oh, my yes, I was an advisor for right. Jeb, so truth and lending here, all right?
Right, of course. So... in terms of when you hear Trump talking, translate this level of certainty that he has. Is it? I'm just going to ask you flat out. Is it unwarranted?
Of course it is. These are complicated issues. All right, and if you can only get to that level of certainty by oversimplifying them, by denying that there really is nuance, by denying all the countervailing information that might be out there pushing against your conclusion. Actually, to actually give you a real sense of my response to many of these, and it's just not him. I mean,
right.
there are others in the campaign. It's not so much wrong or overly certain. It's incoherent.
Right.
I mean, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
All right. I got involved personally in this little kerfuffle about whether or not we're going to kill innocent civilians.
Yeah. Okay. The comment that Donald Trump made that he would, quote unquote, go after families. And by the way, he tried to walk it back.
And so, you know, I make that comment on Bill Maher's show. It gets a little bit of play. Right. Frankly, I thought I was pointing out Newton's second law of physics or something. I mean, like, if you let something go, it falls. I mean, it was just pointing out something I thought was obvious.
Right.
But it made news. The next week, Bret Baier asked the candidate that question in one of the debates. And he says, I'm a leader. People will do it. Don't worry about it. Even going after terrorist families. And then the candidate begins to lay out this story about the families fleeing 2 days before 9/11, the families going elsewhere, the families watching all of this on TV.
Right.
That's completely fantastical.
Right.
There is no data that supports any thread of that story. Most of the 9/11 hijackers weren't married. None of them had families inside the United States. And there's no evidence that any family members moved before, during, or after 9/11. It was completely made up. And so I'm having trouble getting coherence in some of the views.
Well, we seem to have changed the paradigm for this election.
What I just told you doesn't seem to matter to some fraction of our electorate.
So you're a guy who has seen absolutely everything. You were part of the Daily Intelligence briefing. You know, like, how frightening is it that you have people out here who potentially will win major party nominations who have this sort of attitude?
Well, let me be clear. Let me use a tried and true intelligence officer technique. Let me elevate the problem one level of abstraction.
Yes.
All right. This is not confined to this election or that candidate, all right? Our political process demands, particularly when there are highly contested elections and there's a crowded field,
right?
Our process demands differentiation. You get differentiation by being dramatic.
Right.
And so this isn't the only time this happens. So after someone then gets elected, all right, I had teams, the director of national intelligence had teams, okay, pre-positioned in Chicago and in Phoenix.
Right.
You know, nearly 8 years
Obama
ago.
Obama has talked about this.
Waiting to find out who carried Ohio and Florida, and then who's going to get these briefings.
And the team in Chicago was
the
better.
Next morning.
No, I'm
better. Yeah. All right. And at that point, the permanent government, that's folks like me, all right?
Yeah.
We actually go all out to impress upon the winning candidate our view of the world. All right. And I talk about this in the narrative a bit. A line I use is to impress upon the candidate that national security looks different from the Oval Office than it does from a hotel room in Iowa.
Right.
And to create as many heck, although I didn't quite say heck in the book, heck moments as possible, as in heck. I wish I hadn't said that in Schenectady.
Right.
All right. In other words, trying to take the candidate, and I guess my point I'm trying to make here is it applies to all of them.
But I will say one thing. You're being, I appreciate your diplomacy on this, but this, it seems to me that this is a different kind. This one particular candidate is different.
Well, no. We'll be coming back from a greater distance than I've ever experienced
before.
Are
you confident that this guy, let's just talk Turkey, because I think it's important that people discuss this because, you know, frankly, I find these debates incredibly unsatisfying in terms of the level of detail. They're just nonsensical.
No. Right.
Okay. Are you confident that this guy, Donald Trump, has the capacity, the intellectual curiosity and the willingness to make the kind of adjustment that Barack Obama made when your team addressed him?
Look, I have to give you a perfectly honest answer. I don't know. I don't see evidence of that yet, but I don't know. And I'm not going to prejudge. But I don't see, other than the modest walk back that we're not going to kill the women and children.
That going after them meant, I don't know, buying them ice cream.
Yeah. Other than that modest walk back, I've not seen much to-ing and fro-ing to correct the record after a particularly outlandish statement.
What's the craziest thing you've heard? So apart from, I guess you've isolated that, you've isolated the going after the families thing.
Yeah.
But in general, what's the craziest thing, most irresponsible thing you've heard said by anyone in this cycle so far?
We're going to close our borders to all the adherents to one of the world's great monotheisms until we figure something out.
Logistically, how does one do a religion test? Out of curiosity. If you were asked to implement, you would not because it's not your bellow.
You can't do it. But let me tell you why why that one just naturally comes to the surface. Look, the narrative of those who would will us harm in this current conflict, I'm talking about jihadism 2.0, the fundamental narrative is that there is unrelenting, unavoidable hostility between Islam and what you and I call the modern world, all right? Now, that's not true. There are some adherents of Islam who believe it to be true, but it's not,
right?
All right? Why would we act then as if it were? Why would we allow someone who's got some prominence in American society to actually say they all hate us, or at least a lot of them hate us when pressed? To what did that first sentence mean? And then to actually make the statement, we're going to close our borders to all of these people. We are living their narrative. We are validating their casus belli.
Right.
Why would you do that?
Right. Do you think it's already done damage?
I have said publicly that it, of course, it matters who gets elected.
Right.
All right. But I have said publicly, having said that already, has made the United States less safe than it would otherwise be.
And how, just to play that one less level of abstraction and one more level of concretion, if that's a word. I just made it up. So the how would that manifest? Just recruiting?
It would manifest in recruiting. It would manifest in you know, you've got 1.5 billion adherents to a great monotheism out there. And frankly, Mr. Trump gets some credence in response to the unwillingness of the current administration to say that this has anything to do with Islam. I mean, there is a point counterpoint issue being made here, and so.
So you think to some extent Obama, by this almost categorical refusal has created a counter-reaction that
somehow makes what Mr. Trump's saying welcome to some Americans. Because I think most Americans realize saying this has nothing to do with Islam flies in the face of reality.
And you were critical of the president's reaction. You were critical of the president's statement that he made in the wake of the Brussels attacks, right? That you thought it was too brief.
I did, but I actually critical is probably not the right word.
Okay.
My observation was that was not an unforced error, that was not a weakness, that was not a mistake. That was policy.
It was reflective of his.
It reflects his view of where in the taxonomy of dangers facing the United States terrorism resides, and it's not at the top of his list.
Now, do you think that, I mean, the implication is you believe he's in error here?
Oh, I do. I do, all right? And I think I would wish he was more participatory in pushing back. This is not my claiming the president is unresponsive to all this and so on. Number one, that's not right. Number two, that's not my role. All right. If you're asking me my opinion, I think what it is we're doing is, my phrase has been, under-resourced and over-regulated. I would wish we could do a lot more. Now, we fast forward to Mr. Trump saying we're going to kill the women and children.
Right.
All right. That's ridiculous. All right. We reject that on his face. But Trump saying we need to be tougher, that's actually a fair argument. I do think we need to be tougher. I do think our tolerance for collateral damage is far too low. And by the way, that's not my being insensitive to innocent life, because you realize that if you avoid strikes day in and day out because of a fear of collateral damage, you are very likely to actually end up with more dead innocents, because you have not disabled an enemy that makes war on the innocent.
But hasn't this president, he's taken a lot of crap from the left because of the collateral damage about the drone strike. So you're saying that to some extent this is patty cake.
Well, actually being what I was, all right, I get to be perhaps people expect me to be a more objective observer on this. I don't have to go political, right?
Absolutely.
And so let me give you an observation.
Yep.
All right, the most striking observation, judging the 43rd and the 44th president of the United States when it comes to fighting terrorism, the most striking observation I can give you is their continuity, not their difference. And I would make, without fear, make the claim there are bigger differences between the first and second Bush administration. By that, I mean 43-1 and 43-2.
They're going to kick you right off Fox.
Than there is between 43 and 44.
What are the big... Explain, I'm sure... explain to me... just play that out.
Sure. In the second George W. Bush administration, we took an awful lot of the measures we undertook as an emergency response,
right,
and more regularized them, put them more under Congress, put them more under the court. We actually had, where we were 8 years ago now, all right, as we were preparing for that election and for that transition, we were moving heaven and earth to get the things we were doing in packages that allowed them to be transferable to the next administration. And guess what? The next administration pretty much picked up most of the packages. Targeted killings? Oh, you bet. State secret? Yes. Guantanamo still open. I understand the policy decision, but the Guantanamo is still open. We still have forever prisoners. President Obama agrees there are some people we will never try and we will never release. He kept the metadata program.
Oh, absolutely. Through Holder, you authorized some expansions?
Yes.
I mean, and you got rid of the enhanced interrogation stuff
now,
was gone.
Now the difference is he closed the CIA black sites and he confined everyone to the techniques of the Army Field Manual. Did I agree with that? No. But I'm objective enough to observe that for the most part, the thrust here is, I'll give you a quote in the book. This is when I'm talking about Edward Snowden and the Germans are hyperventilating a bit about what we may or may not have been doing. And there's a quote in Spiegel that I re-quote in the book. It's from a German, and he says, "We thought it was just George Bush. We thought there were two Americas. Now we know there is only one America."
Interesting.
Now, from my point of view, cool. All right, I view that to be a positive. But it also demonstrates what many Europeans now view as what I'm trying to tell you, the continuity between the two administrations. And so that, by the way, that makes everything I just related to you not about Texas.
Yes.
It makes it about America.
Okay, so here is a question. Who is a larger threat to that continuity, which you view as being golden, Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton?
Donald Trump.
Why?
Because I view his current statements as erratic. And I guess... answering your question with Mr. Trump's name, simply because I just don't know what it is he's going to do. I have seen some performance on the part of Secretary Clinton.
Give me an assessment based on, and obviously she played a subordinate role in the administration. I don't think people really appreciate how subordinate that role was at times. I think she was not a decider on some of these issues. And by the way, it behooves neither the Democrats or the Republicans to point that out. Give me just sort of an assessment of what you saw when she was in the Senate and what you saw at Foggy Bottom.
You know, I'm not going to give you a good answer because wasn't part of my job. She wasn't on my committees.
Right.
Wasn't on the Intel Committee. I had 2 or 3 weeks overlap with her as I served for President Obama until Leon Panetta was confirmed. I did brief her on CIA covert actions, which is required since she was the incoming Secretary of State. She was a quick study. She understood what I was saying, and I left. So I just don't have any metrics by which to answer your question.
But you seem to have a general sense that she is a responsible person.
In terms of what it is we're talking about,
right,
in terms of the lane in which I worked about national security, yeah.
Do you think...
By the way, a lot of my friends will point to Benghazi and a whole bunch of other things. But to honestly answer your question, this is an experienced diplomat, an experienced woman, who seems to have taken these questions seriously.
Is Benghazi disqualifying?
A
lot of Republicans have said that.
I understand. Look, you want me to talk about Benghazi?
Yeah.
Benghazi was a play in three acts, all right? The focus of most Americans has been in Act Two. Act Two lasted precisely 13 hours,
yep,
and you understand what
yes,
I'm referring
sir.
To. I am willing to be very forgiving about Act Two. I have been in Act Twos. Act Twos are tough. It's hard to make things come out happy when you're in an Act Two, all right? It's quite possible that everyone did just about everything we would have expected of them. Now, look, Chairman Gowdy may come up with some really big news before he's done.
Right.
But right now, I am willing to be forgiving about Act Two. Not so Act One. How in God's name could you put that man out there with such a light security footprint, knowing what we obviously knew about Benghazi at that time? In Act 3, I am equally critical. Oh, come on. Just tell me what happened. We don't have to live the cover story about the video. Right. I'm an adult. Tell me what went wrong.
Right. Absolutely. And, well, you know, a lot of people don't say this, but a lot of people don't say this publicly, but what I have heard, and I'm sure you have heard the same thing, is that this was the ambassador's chosen mode of operation.
It could very well be.
But at some point, somebody should have intervened.
Somebody needs to be saying, this is just not going to happen, Chris.
Okay, another question, which I'm just going to throw at you, and you can tell me to jump in a lake, since it peripherally involves another CIA director, David Petraeus. What is your general overview? I'm sure you've been asked this before of the email thing. Do you see this as something potentially disqualifying?
I really don't know because we really don't know.
Right.
All right. Let me tell you what I've allowed myself to say publicly. Okay. In my view, the sin you need to be concerned about here is the original sin. You can't make this come out happy once you set it up the way the email server and distribution had been set up. All right. Once you've set it up that way, nobody has to be dumb, lazy, bad, or insensitive to classification. It is going to end up the way it has ended up, which is a very embarrassing place. And so what I wonder is, why didn't someone simply say, ma'am, this is just not going to happen? I can't do this.
Well, I think I've covered Hillary Clinton on and off for 15 years, and I will tell you, I think that the people in her direct orbit were people who were being paid not to say that.
Well, you know, I don't know. I don't know the people. Yeah. I don't know the circumstance. But I do know anybody with my experience in government, once we've been told that's how you've set it up, we go, oh.
Well, that setup was, I guess the word I would use is exotic. But she has actually, it's interesting watching the progression of her public statements on this. She has very much defaulted to using Colin Powell as a bit of a human shield on this, saying that he had a similar setup. Do you think that's exculpatory?
It wasn't a similar setup. He didn't have a server in his home. And in terms of the raw volume of email, there's almost no comparison between the two. Look, people like me in government, looking at the setup, simply say, that's inconceivable. And then looking at the subsequent explanations of it, we get to say, that's incoherent.
So I'm going to ask you a question that was asked on Fox and Friends, because I generally like to vet my questions with them before I ask them to you.
It's obvious. It's clear.
It's obvious, yeah. So who would you, let's go down the list. Who would you say is in terms of issues of national intelligence, terrorism, your bailiwick, the best prepared from day one to serve as commander-in-chief?
That's pretty easy. That's John Kasich. All right?
Why?
Number one, look at him in the debates. He doesn't dumb these things down below the level of bumper stickers.
Right.
He actually respects the complexity of the problems. All right. He doesn't insert over emotional content in what are very, very difficult issues. And obviously, he's respecting these as shades of gray, not simplistic black and white. He's also got good experience as an executive.
And this is a guy who's been. This is a guy who truly understands the briefing process.
He's been an executive, and when he was in Congress, he was on the Armed Services Committees, where people gave him very, very good marks.
Who's number two?
Number two, for the question you asked me.
Yes.
In the narrowly defined national security lane, I'm not talking about all the stuff to the right and all the stuff to the left.
Yep.
Number two right now, best prepared from day one, Secretary Clinton.
Come on.
No.
Why?
Because she's well prepared.
So you're going to vote for her?
As I told you, there are a lot of things to the left here, a lot of things to the right. Besides that, remember that Australian secret ballot theory we operate under
I'm
here?
Sorry about that. Yeah, we keep forgetting the Aussies gave that to us. What a shame. In terms, obviously, we have seen another terrible attack in Brussels this week. What is it sort of, you know, I've been very interested in some of the reporting here, just saying that the Belgians really don't have their act together.
Yeah.
Give me sort of your general overview and how you think this ultimately impacts this country.
So we're not out of the woods. The threat here is never zero. That said, we have realities that make us different than what we saw in Europe. A couple of realities. We're actually pretty good at this. I mean, our intelligence services are big and powerful and frankly pretty tough, and back to continuity, pretty aggressive. under two very different presidents.
Right.
So number one, our services are good. Number two, geography. We're further from Raqqa. We're further from Mosul. We don't have the migrant population. We don't have the refugee population that they have. All right. And number three, we're a different society. We are actually a welcoming society. We know how to assimilate groups. We have radicalized individuals in the United States. We don't have radicalized communities.
Right.
We have it within our ability to create radicalized communities. And therefore, people of my background would like to caution others to be careful what they say with regard to patrolling certain communities or closing our borders to certain people.
Right.
We have it within our ability to create radicalized communities.
But didn't Jeb, wasn't well, Jeb, and this may have been, I don't know if you were involved in this particular, I recall Jeb calling for the admission of Christian refugees. There was some differentiation that Bush.
I don't think okay. Jeb did that. Some people did. All right. I would never have said let the Christians in, keep the Muslims out. On the other hand, when you're going through a screening process that you apply to everyone equally, all right, religion might actually be one of the factors in the totality of factors that you use to make judgments as to who can come in soon, who has to wait for further checking.
Which is something which is controversial, but it's something the country has done in the past.
Of course.
Okay. The final thing is, and we haven't actually talked explicitly about the book all that much.
I keep trying to bring it up.
I have started it. I've read a lot of the reviews of it. So let's talk today. I think it was today. A person you're somewhat familiar with, Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. I would like to acquaint you. She's a Democrat from California. Yeah. She used to be on the Intelligence Committee, I think, as you're aware. Took some issue with your claims that enhanced interrogation techniques were effective.
Right. Not just my claims, mind you, but she did take issue with my specific claims. I'm not the only one claiming that.
Why? How does she get this? From your perspective, why is she getting this so horribly wrong?
The real answer is I don't know. All right?
And by the way, I'm not saying she's getting horribly wrong. I'm saying from your perspective,
it's horribly wrong. Yeah. Look, I went into this in the summer of 2006 and spent the summer, it's my first summer as director, studying this program. I could have cut and run. The program was in stasis. I could have walked away from this. I could have said that was then, this is now, we're not doing this anymore. All right? But I spent the summer of 2006 learning as much as I could about this program, reading documents. I had massive binders that I would go through on weekends. I would be able to bring them home. I talked to people. I talked to people who were our interrogators. I talked to people who were involved in the program, analysts who harvested the information that we got. And I formed a judgment that although we could change this program, I was not going to recommend to the president that we end it, that I wanted to keep this capacity available to him and, frankly, to his successor. We emptied the sites. We didn't close them. I convinced Steve Hadley that we weren't the nation's jailers, but that we might from time to time want to keep people in these sites to get good intelligence from them. We weren't going to keep people in these sites forever. I put a time limit on it, about 60 days, although I could extend it. And although we used to have 13 techniques, we took 7 off the table and stuck with 6. 4, frankly, were pretty light. 2 weren't. The 2 that weren't were managing diet and sleep deprivation. And we moved forward on that. That was my best judgment. It was based on truth as I know it, just like my chapter in the book was based on truth as I know it. I glanced very briefly before you came over here today at the point counterpoint. It looks right. Very much like the appendix in the original summary that was put out last December. I said this, they say that. But she doesn't take just me on. She takes the people I quote on. She takes John McLaughlin on. She takes the agency's view that we got valuable information out of this on.
But I guess the frustration is you can't divulge what information it is in most
instances. Well, to the best of my ability, I divulge the information we got in the book, all right, and defend the positions that the government took.
Give me a paradigm. Give me sort of the paramount example of an instance, and this has been litigated, so I don't want to spend too much time on it.
Yeah, I actually, frankly, I tire of this issue.
Okay. All right? We'll move forward.
I'll answer your question.
Yeah.
But you know, we'll let history litigate
this. Okay, does it piss you off that this thing keeps coming up over and over again?
It does, because I just told you I tire of this issue. All right? The agency has a view. Some members of the Senate have a different view. By the way, there are other members of the Senate who associate themselves with the agency view. Yeah,
you
on
are
this.
In this book, you are very tough on sort of the Senate. You're also very tough on some reporters who you think have an agenda.
Yeah. And by the way, yeah. The ones I come down hard on are the ones who self-identify as advocacy journalists.
You're talking about Jane Mayer?
Jane Mayer is one. Glenn Greenwald is another. Right. Laura Poitras is a third.
Right. Right. Don't you think, but to some extent, now here's and this is a good point to conclude on. One of the things that really differentiates you from other folks who have served in your position is that you have a genuine desire to have the public understand the process better, because you think there needs to be buy-in. That is the same, by the way, self-defined motive of some of these reports. I happen to know Jane Mayer quite well, right, and I respect her a great deal. Tell me why you think that role that she plays is, I won't use the term illegitimate, you haven't used that term.
I've not said that.
Why do you think she goes too far in terms of the advocacy? Make the argument to me why you think you're right and she's wrong.
Yeah, and frankly, I differentiate her a little bit from Greenwald and Poitras.
Yeah.
All right? But I'm waiting to see the positive article about the Central Intelligence Agency that she chooses to write. I'm waiting to see the good news that she's willing to articulate about CIA. It is, her articles, I think, to be fair, are pretty relentlessly prosecutorial.
But isn't there a role for that? There's
a
lot of people who are going to write positive
articles.
Of course
there is, but you just asked me, you know, about agendas. Okay, that's her role. I criticize it, but I don't condemn it. And frankly, you're right. Yeah. I pretty much in that chapter say, game on.
Right.
Let me tell you my side of this story. And the more I can get what my community, believes to be truth out there, the more I'm comfortable about letting the massive Americans crowdsource this and decide whether or not they want their intelligence services to be
doing
this.
Because your capacity, that's the thing that's happening. Your capacity to control these secrets is diminishing by the minute, right?
It is, but that's not the only argument. All right. It may be that we might want to reveal more of these secrets. And here's the argument I make in the book. We thought we had a handshake back in the 70s that if the president knew and the Congress knew in terms of the oversight committees and in certain instances that the court knew, that's it. That's consent of the governed. Move on.
Right.
And what's happened is the national consensus has moved out from underneath that premise. All right. After some of the Snowden revelations were made, I mean, NSA could fairly point out, wait a minute, two different presidents authorized it.
Right.
The committees not only know about it, they support it, and the court oversees it. We're good to go. That's a line I use in the book. That's the Madisonian trifecta, right? We've got all three branches of government. And a lot of Americans, and not just the wing nuts in this case, a lot of Americans then said, you know, I'm not so sure that constitutes consent of the governed anymore. That may actually be consent of the governors. You may have told them, but you didn't tell me.
Right.
And that's the challenge my old community now has. How much of what it is we do can we make more public without making it not worth doing in the first place?
Here's a question. So overclassification has been a big bugaboo for people.
Which I freely admit in the book.
What do you think, and I know you address some of this in the book, but what do you think can be, what are some data points or some programs you think that could be spoken about in a more transparent, publicly disseminated way that are not currently being talked about?
The United States has a program of targeted killings underway that I think meet all the definitions of the laws of armed conflict: necessity, distinction, proportionality. All right. We very often vacate the field of argument on that by not putting sufficient data out there and allow others, whom I again think might be agended, maybe not consciously, maybe not in wishing to be unfair, but certainly have a point of view, to allow them to express what now has become the quote-unquote journalistic record about targeted killings, a record, by the way, that does not comport with my life experience. And so there's an instance where I actually think the government would be more well-served by being more transparent.
To give more information so that people can, so that you can make the counter argument.
That's correct.
Were you censored heavily
in writing the book?
Yes.
Actually, I knew there were some things I shouldn't write about, and I didn't try.
So you pre-censored?
A little bit. There are other things I thought I should write about, and I wrote. And at the end of the day, everything I thought should be in that book is in that book.
Can you give me a sense as to what you self-censored on, in a broad area?
Some covert action operations that have not yet been made public, and I wasn't going to do it in the book.
Do you think they will become public in the not-too-distant future?
Everything becomes public sooner or later.
Final question. And again, this gets back to my bone to pick with being a reporter, right? but I just want to kind of get back to this, because you sort of talk about, and I'm not talking about Mayer in particular, I think Greenwald is sort of sui generis.
And I did make the distinction.
Yeah,
between Mayer and Greenwald and Pritchard.
Does a guy like Greenwald? Well, let's take Greenwald, because he can be a pain in the ass to those of us who are civilians too, right?
Yes, he believes you're kept men and women. I believe
I am a kept man. Thank you very much. But I mean, the question I have though is, even though he's a pain in the ass, even though he steps over the line, don't you think, just in terms of each force, every force has an opposite and equal force. Don't you think that role of being a gadfly, a pain in the ass, even though you are, I hate to call you this, but you are a man of a bureaucracy. You have been a man of many bureaucracies.
Yeah, that does hurt. Go ahead.
Sorry. Don't you think him playing that gadfly, pain in the ass, somewhat irresponsible role actually has a function, keeping you honest and pulling you towards the light?
So I was asked on 60 Minutes, and I recount this in the book, about another reporter, Jim Risen,
right,
who was going to be dragged into court and perhaps dragged into jail for not revealing his source, which apparently was Jeffrey Sterling, based upon the court judgment.
Right.
All right. Revealing a covert action program against the Iranian nuclear program. And, I was asked, was that a serious leak? Yeah. Did it cause harm? You bet it caused harm. What do you think should happen to Mr. Risen? Should he be forced to go to jail if he does not reveal his source? And I think it was Scott Pelley asking me the question. I think I surprised him by saying, no, I don't think so. You know, the First Amendment's sacred, even when in my view, it is being abused. All right. Back to the question of collateral damage. Mr. Risen may or may not have deserved something,
right?
But the collateral damage to the health of the First Amendment made doing anything against Mr. Risen, to my mind, cost prohibitive. And there's another part of the book where when my public affairs officer comes running down the hall with his hair on fire saying, oh my God, we got to stop this story. That means he wants me to call an editor or a publisher because he's not having his way with the with the correspondent, with the reporter. I began every one of those conversations. By the way, they all took my call, which is actually much to their credit.
And you were able to forestall
They viewed this to be serious.
Right.
And I began every one of those conversations with, look, I understand, and I meant this, I understand we both have a role to play in preserving American liberty and safety. But I'm afraid the way you're about to do your job is going to make it harder for me to do mine. Can we talk? And in every instance, we had a serious conversation. I won some, I lost some, and some were a mix. But we had a serious conversation. That speaks well for the Fourth Estate.
Well, thanks. Well, I lied. I'm now about to disabuse you of that notion that things are working well with us. One last question. So you've been out a while, obviously quite a long while now, and you've been doing other things. You worked on this book. What your general view of the way that these bureaucracies function? Obviously, the world is changing fast. Has your perspective on this stuff changed in a significant way?
A little bit, and maybe I've changed, and maybe the bureaucracies have changed. I mean, it's been more than 7 years now.
Right.
All right. I would look back and if someone inside said, Mike, what should I be worried about?
Right.
What are the broad things you think I need to be aware of? My view is, you guys are looking a bit slow-moving, bureaucratic, overly cautious, and overly lawyered. You might want to take a look at that.
Which gets us back to the Trump discussion, but we're not going to circle back. General, thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you.
It was a real pleasure.
Thanks.